May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice, Justices, Mr. Wallace. For the record, I'm Jan Van Amerongen. I represent Javon Lemons, the defendant below appellant, with respect to his appeal from his conviction at trial of one count of conspiracy first degree, more specifically conspiring to commit the crime of murder in the first degree. The indictment alleged that he conspired with one Eric Branch. Eric Branch was indicted in a separate indictment. His trial didn't go forward. He ended up taking a plea after the resolution of Mr. Lemons' case at trial. As the court, I'm sure, is aware, Mr. Lemons was acquitted at trial of the murder first degree, as well as the charge of possession of a firearm during commission of a felony. The only guilty verdict returned by the jury was the conspiracy in the first degree. The evidence at trial that was presented by the state consisted of several alleged witnesses or eyewitnesses. I say alleged because even though Shaquille Washington indicated that he was present, none of the other witnesses that testified on behalf of the state said that he was there or even mentioned him in either their interviews to the police or in their trial testimony. However, there were several witnesses that indicated Mr. Lemons was in the vicinity of Van Buren Street in the city of Wilmington on this date. And essentially what happened is Mr. Owens and Mr. Anderson, who were friends, were walking on Van Buren Street looking for a party. When they approached an intersection, they passed an intersection at which several people were gathered. There were two girls there, Tarika Watson and Tashay Briscoe, who were friends with one another. And in fact, I'll stick with they were friends with one another. They both testified to what they believed they saw. Mr. Owens testified to what he believed he saw. Jameel Biddle ended up being called by the defense, and he testified with respect to the events that transpired. This, according to the state, arose out of either a bump, which was viewed as disrespectful by Mr. Branch or Mr. Biddle, depending on who testified received the bump, or a disrespectful look being given by the victim, Mr. Anderson, to Mr. Branch. It was never alleged by any witness that Mr. Lemons was bumped or that Mr. Lemons was the one that was the recipient, if you will, of this disrespectful look. Nonetheless, it was alleged by the state that Mr. Branch, together with Mr. Lemons, came up with the plan to kill Mr. Anderson as a result of this disrespectful bump and or look. The evidence with respect to any agreement is virtually non-existent. What happened is that, according to Tashay Briscoe, she overheard, she saw no bump. She overheard Mr. Branch indicating that he had been the recipient of some kind of look. She indicated in her trial testimony that at some point Mr. Lemons walks away and comes back, and Mr. Branch gives Mr. Lemons a revolver or a handgun. She testifies that after Owens and Anderson had continued up the block, a few seconds later, Mr. Lemons and Mr. Branch continue or walk up that way as well. Shortly thereafter, she says that she hears shots that were unrelated to this incident coming from another direction, but she sees at the time there is one gunshot fired, which presumably is the one shot that killed Mr. Anderson. She sees only one person with their arm raised, and she indicated that was Mr. Lemons. Tarika Watson, Tashay Briscoe's friend, testified that she also saw no bump. She just saw Owens and Anderson walk past the group. She says that Mr. Branch was complaining about some kind of look, but she said that Mr. Branch pulls a weapon out of his waistband and puts it back into his own waistband, does not say that he gives it to Mr. Lemons. She also does not say that anybody other than herself saw this. It may be that others saw that, but her testimony was that Mr. Branch took the weapon out and put it back into his own waistband. There is no testimony that Mr. Lemons saw it, reacted to it, responded verbally to it, said, okay, let's go get him, nothing. At that point, according to Ms. Watson, there's no further discussion, and the two men just start walking in the direction of Van Buren Street, in which Mr. Anderson and Mr. Owens had walked. According to both girls, though, shortly after Branch and Lemons and or others proceeded up the street, the two girls proceeded up the street. They both testified that neither one of them believed anything was going to happen. They didn't believe there was any danger to themselves or others in walking up the block after these two. So even though they testified to what they heard and what they saw, they themselves didn't feel that there was anything about to happen. Shaquille Washington testified, and he testified that he had actually been with the group. He testified that he was one of the girls' boyfriends, had been talking to them for several minutes, and that he walked up the block with Mr. Branch and Mr. Lemons. None of the other witnesses had mentioned Mr. Washington as being there at all. Mr. Washington testified that based upon where all of the actors were standing at the time of the shooting, in essence, it must have been Mr. Lemons that fired the shot, because the lethal shot entered Mr. Anderson's head on the left side of his head, behind his ear, sort of at the base of his skull. And according to Mr. Washington, Mr. Branch was standing to Mr. Anderson's right, and Mr. Lemons was to his left. And therefore, what the state argued is that it must have been Mr. Lemons who fired the shot. Well, the jury certainly heard all of the evidence, took everything into account, and returned verdicts of not guilty with respect to the murder first and not guilty with respect to the firearm during commission of a felony possession. With respect to the conspiracy, what we can conclude, I believe, is that either Mr. Branch or Mr. Lemons can commit an overt act for which, if there is an agreement, they would both be responsible and both be guilty of a conspiracy. In this case, the jury, in essence, found that Mr. Lemons did not commit the overt act in finding not...
Which overt act?
Well, in committing the murder first degree.
But that's one of several overt acts alleged in the indictment, right?
Well, they don't allege specific acts. They say murder first degree, attempted murder first degree, or other acts.
Right.
And
Was there a bill of particulars filed explaining the other acts?
No, Your Honor. There wasn't, but I would indicate to the court that there's no evidence of any other acts being made on the part of Mr. Lemons at all. Now, Mr. Branch, if Mr. Branch was the shooter, presumably had the weapon and used it, which, if there was an agreement by Mr. Lemons with Mr. Branch to aid or assist the endeavor, and if the endeavor was murder first degree, then there would be a conspiracy. But there is no evidence that there was any agreement, let alone an agreement to commit murder first degree.
Well, the trial court found circumstantial evidence of that.
Well, the trial court found circumstantial evidence and indicated that the motive, if you will, was retaliation for the perceived disrespect. However, the circumstantial evidence found by the court is that Mr. Lemons was there, that Mr. Lemons walked in the direction, the same direction or with Mr. Branch, and that a murder was committed. That quite simply is not enough. I would argue to the court that White versus State, 2006 case, I believe it is 806 Atlantic 2nd 82, which dealt with a conspiracy in conspiracy to commit drug trafficking. In that case, there was evidence of presence in the sense that that defendant was present in a bedroom next to a walk-in closet where over 100 grams of cocaine were found. There was even evidence of knowledge of her own son's criminal behavior going on in that apartment, but this court determined that that evidence alone, mere presence as well as possibly knowledge of ongoing criminal activity, is not enough to support a conspiracy finding. In this case, Your Honor, I would indicate that the same thing has happened, that he was merely present. Based upon the evidence, Jamil Biddle was also present. Jamil Biddle may have also seen this display of a firearm that Tarika Watson described. Jamil Biddle also proceeded up the street, but he is not charged. The state's theory was that Mr. Lemons was the one that fired the weapon, that Mr. Lemons is the one who committed all these acts, and once that's taken off the board, there's
Was it argued by the defense that Branch was the shooter?
It was argued by the defense that Branch could have been the shooter. I can't recall specifically if I said the evidence might even suggest he probably was the shooter, versus even Mr. Washington as having been the shooter. But it wouldn't surprise me, Your Honor, if I had said that Branch was the one who received the slight and took vengeance on his own.
Well, if the jury had accepted that argument, would that act by Branch be an overt act?
Well, it is an overt act, but I don't believe it would be an overt act in furtherance of any conspiracy, absent any agreement or any assistance from Mr. Lemons.
Wasn't there some testimony by one of the witnesses that that a gun was handed to your client?
There was.
As the walking was going on?
It was before the walking was going on, but yes, Tashay Briscoe indicated that Mr. Branch removed the handgun from his waistband and gave it to Mr. Lemons. And she indicated that then the walking took place, that she, along with Tarika Watson, followed, and then at the time of the gunshots, she saw Mr. Lemons with his hand up. She didn't indicate that she could see him holding a weapon or see it firing, but she said of all the people who she could see, and she could see everybody that was involved in this, it was only Mr. Lemons that had his hand raised.
So if there's evidence that your client had a gun shortly before the murder was committed and was walking with the person who, presumably, if it wasn't your client, is the one who committed the murder, why isn't that enough of a connection to imply an agreement?
Your Honor, I would indicate that there is not enough of a connection to imply an agreement because even though a juror heard that evidence, the standard is even giving the evidence, when you view the evidence in the light most favorable to the state, it's whether or not a rational juror can believe beyond a reasonable doubt that each essential element has been proven. And in this case, since the jury concluded that my client was not guilty of possession of a firearm during commission of a felony, and since what was argued and what was testified to by Ms. Briscoe basically is that my client was the one who actually had the gun and fired it, there's no testimony that if he was given the gun, he gave it back to Mr. Branch and that Mr. Branch used it. I'm not going to say that her testimony was she never looked away from them and saw them constantly, but she followed them and saw what was going on.
Okay, let me put it a different way. The jury decided that your client did not commit murder. Let me back up. The jury decided that it could not convict your client of murder, right?
Yes.
But somebody was murdered, and your client was right there when it happened, and that's clear, right?
Right there or in the vicinity, depending, yes.
Okay, so
within a block.
Why does it matter for purposes of a conspiracy charge whether the jury decided that your client committed the murder or not?
Well, I will agree that it's not dispositive of the issue. This court has certainly indicated in past cases that even if the substantive charge, I'll call it, results in an acquittal, there can be evidence of a conspiracy. It could be because a second person committed the overt acts. Mm-hmm. And the fact that he was shot, I would submit, is an overt act. But I guess where I would urge the court to come out is that there has to have been an agreement of something. What was alleged was that there was an agreement to commit murder in the first degree. Whether there was an agreement to threaten or an agreement to scare or an agreement to kill, there still had to have been an agreement. And it has to have been proven beyond a reasonable doubt. What there is some comments from Mr. Branch about being disrespected. There is an allegation in a 3507 statement from Tashay Briscoe that Mr. Lemons says, come on, before they walk. But that's the only, I think, the only words that are attributed to Mr. Lemons other than what do you want to do, which I think may also have been Ms. Briscoe in her 3507 statement, although she didn't testify to that in her live testimony.
Well, the trial judge said, quote, there is certainly sufficient circumstantial evidence for a jury to infer that Mr. Branch and defendant discussed retaliating against Mr. Anderson, that defendant knew of the criminal objective from the presence of the firearm, and that defendant agreed to aid Mr. Branch when the two set off in pursuit of Mr. Anderson. Is that supported by the record?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. And I believe that since this is a de novo review, this court should look through all of the facts and determine whether that's supported by the record. I don't believe it is.
What exactly isn't supported?
I don't believe that, if the judge says, the judge did say that there was an inference, I suppose, of planning. I apologize for not remembering the exact words that Justice Ridgely just read to me. There was a discussion, perhaps, but the discussion that was overheard, according to the testimony, consisted of Branch complaining and possibly Lemon saying, what are you going to do? And then after he had walked away and came back and said, come on, that's it. If we're going to speculate or infer about more conversation, I don't think that's supported by the record.
Well, don't you judge that conversation, or at least the inferences to be drawn from what followed?
I think in some cases it's a circumstance that can be looked at, but I think what we have to look at is not what Mr. Branch ended up doing if Mr. Branch was the shooter, but what Mr. Lemons perceived in terms of it being his agreement.
After the victim or deceased, however you want to refer to him, walked away toward Van Buren or down Van Buren, whichever it was, is there any evidence whether Lemons and Branch altered their course to follow them?
No, Your Honor. The state, certainly in its argument at trial, indicated that, and I believe even in the brief that was submitted to this court, indicated that they followed them, they pursued them, and they hunted them. But there was no testimony that Anderson and Owens went anywhere other than straight up Van Buren Street for five or six blocks and then turned around and started coming back, and that Branch, Lemons, and or Washington and Biddle proceeded straight up Van Buren Street. So there's nothing that indicates anybody turned and followed anybody, if I understand the question.
My question was, were they headed to point A before the disrespect was displayed, and then they changed their course to go in the same direction as the victim?
My recollection is that there was no testimony about where any of them were headed before being at that intersection, that they were talking with the girls at the intersection. There was testimony about everybody knowing that there was a party in the area, but nobody really knew where it was or who was holding it. But I think that was an objective of all the people there, was to find this party. I would reserve my further time, Your Honor.
All right.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Mr. Chief Justice, Justices, good afternoon. Paul Wallace on behalf of the appellee of the State of Delaware. To answer the Chief Justice's factual question first, my understanding of how this played out was actually the group, including Mr. Branch and Mr. Lemons, were stationary when Mr. Anderson and Owens happened by, and there was either the bump or the look or some act of disrespect. And what Tarika Watson and Tashay Briscoe are able to fill in for us and able to make clear that a jury could rationally infer became an agreement to go after Anderson and Owens is that Branch complains, he was grinning me, he bumped me, he did something. Both women say they hear that portion of it. But what Tarika Watson makes clear is that Owens, I'm sorry, that Lemons and Branch in some way separate themselves from that bigger group at first that included the two women and Mr. Biddle, and that they're talking. And both indicate parts of what they can hear, which are talking about the disrespect. Mr. Lemons saying, well, what are you going to do about it, basically. And then Lemons goes off a bit. During that conversation is when Ms. Briscoe actually sees Mr. Branch show the gun in his waistband, and that it's not passed at that point, but that Lemons is on his cell phone, walks up, and walks some distance further away from that grouping and comes back to Branch and urges him to come on.
Well, Mr. Wallace, in the conspiracy indictment says that they conspired to commit first-degree murder or attempted murder. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the indictment could have said they conspired to commit felony assault.
It could have.
So my question is, in your opening statement to us, you say there was an agreement to go after them. That's a quote of what you just told
us. Yes.
You look at the Superior Court's opinion, and it said, it used the word retaliate. So let's assume they agreed to go after them. Let's assume they agreed to retaliate. How do we get to proof beyond a reasonable doubt that they reached an agreement to commit first-degree murder?
Well, I think there are several things, Your Honor. I think the activity itself, the actions that they took thereafter.
Excuse me. When you're answering, as distinguished from an assault. So, you know, my difficulty with this record is, assuming the case in the light most favorable to the state, and that assumption is there's an agreement to do something. My question is, how does something translate into proof beyond a reasonable doubt to commit first-degree murder?
Your Honor, I think that the court can look at the cases it has decided when it talks about an individual actor and showing his intent to kill, for instance. This court has said, clearly you can form that intent in a moment's time, and the person's acts themselves inform what that intent must have been. It's clear. Everybody understands that certainly this bump or look was not in normal society, a more normal, decent society, an executable offense. But certainly we know this. One person formed that intent because Mr. Anderson ended up dead with one single close gunshot wound to his head.
If one person forms the intent, we don't have a conspiracy.
That's
you,
true.
When you were telling us about our cases, you said something can happen in an instant. So if we decide Mr. Lemons wasn't the shooter and the other person formed the intent in an instant on their own, we wind up with a homicide. I'm just trying to get you to identify for me, because I haven't been able to find it, what are those things in the record that if I say A, B, C, D, whatever number you want to pick, says they agreed to commit first-degree murder?
The rational inferences that show that the agreement was for first-degree murder are this. Mr. Branch has a deadly weapon, a firearm. He shows it to Mr. Lemons. They have some discussion that neither woman can hear the totality of, but includes the talking about what had just occurred. And this is a short period of time that all of this unravels. That actually Mr. Lemons comes back and tells him, come on. They both go together. Now, there is a question as to who actually shot, and the jury simply decided it did not have sufficient evidence beyond a reasonable doubt to identify who that shooter was.
Let me interrupt for just a second. You said that Branch has a gun, shows it to Lemons, and then the two of them head off toward the victim. Are you saying that it's reasonable to infer from the fact that he had a gun that there was a conspiracy to commit murder, because after all you can shoot a gun and kill someone? Because can't you also just put the gun, you know, show it to the victim and scare the hell out of him, or shoot him in the ankle or something like that, and you haven't attempted murder or committed murder.
Your Honor, the question then becomes, if there are equal rational inferences, does this court pick one that the jury might have rejected? Yes, certainly. This jury could a rational trier of fact look at all these facts and say, no, I think the agreement was just to go up and scare the heck out of him, or to shoot him in the knee, or to do something else. Or they could find, just as this jury did, it was to commit first-degree murder.
But are they reaching that decision because that's what happened, and therefore that's what the agreement had to be?
I think that it certainly informs what they may rationally believe the agreement to have been. Because when one pulls out a firearm and deadly weapon, when they have this conversation between them that no one can hear, and they immediately set off after the two, one of whom becomes the victim, that's not an irrational decision by a jury to say, yeah, they decided they were going to take one of these guys out. And they did. What they could not decide, based on the fact that they had differing versions of who actually pulled the trigger, Mr. Biddle testified that Eric Branch said he did it, and in fact in his 3507 statement said, which is Court Exhibit 10, said he saw Eric Branch did it. Ms. Briscoe said she saw Mr. Lemon's arm up, and that was the only person. Mr. Owen said he saw Lemons actually shoot him, and Mr. Washington says he believed Lemon was the only one who could have shot him based on where they were. So the question is whether or not this evidence is sufficient for a rational juror to believe that from what happened and what they saw unfold, the passing of a deadly weapon between the two, the immediate action of one to shoot another person in the head in the presence of the other while they're there, and perhaps some of the lack of evidence thereafter.
And just try the question again, and just for clarification. We know that, as I said, giving the state the evidence in the light most favorable to the state, that they had a discussion. And the discussion might have been retaliation, but as Justice Berger said, retaliation could take a lot of forms. But the state didn't pick a lot of forms. The state didn't pick retaliation, assault as the conspiracy. The state picked first-degree murder. If there are many choices on the form of retaliation, the state has picked one. What's the evidence to support the conspiracy to commit first-degree murder or attempted first-degree murder and only those two choices?
Your Honor, the introduction of a deadly weapon, the conversation that we don't know. Your Honor, if we were held to the standard of we must show that these two persons had a meeting of the mind and that there's some formal and heard agreement between two people, we'll never be able to prove conspiracy in the first degree, because good murderers aren't going to say in front of other witnesses, hey, would you like to go shoot that man in the head? Sure, I'd like to go shoot that man in the head. It's going to almost always be circumstantial. And in this case, the circumstances were such that there's knowledge among both that there's a deadly weapon to be used, that they are going to move forward, and that that act occurs after there is some conversation between the two about it and a concert of activity. In fact, Lemon saying, come on, and them both heading down the street, and immediately one or the other, and unfortunately that could never be resolved, shooting the victim in the head. So that is a rational, the jury looking at that can rationally say, yes, that's what they agreed to do, and that's what, in fact, they did. Is there any more evidence? No, there's not. And we'll almost never have it, because nobody's going to make that agreement in a memorialized form for me to bring to this court.
I guess the problem is with flipping that logic. That is what, in fact, one of them did. We don't know whom, and therefore that is what they agreed to do.
The state's suggestion is that's one rational inference that can be drawn, and that's the rational inference that this jury drew. If we had indicted it for a conspiracy in the second degree and that it was a felony assault or something, would that be a rational inference that the jury could draw also? Absolutely. Even if he did end up dead. The state's not disputing that there are other rational inferences that can be drawn from this. But this court's case law says that when a jury does have sufficient evidence to draw a rational inference, that its findings should be upheld. And that's what we are asking for in this particular case.
What is the analytical difference, if any, between what we're doing now and what a trial judge would have to do if presented with a motion for a judgment of acquittal on the conspiracy charge at the close of the state's case?
Your Honor, the court's case law, really, because when the court talks about its standard and scope of review for sufficiency of evidence, there is no difference. In both circumstances, at both levels, the court engages the same level of review, and it looks at all of the evidence in the light most favorable to the state, determining whether or not any rational juror could have found the elements to be proved beyond a reasonable doubt. And the court talks about that both at the superior court level in a motion for judgment of acquittal and at this court's review level, appeal level. It never comes straight out and says it's de novo review. I was looking at the sufficiency of evidence cases, and it always talks about those terms, taking the Davis language, that's the standard and scope of review. So analytically, there really isn't a difference.
How would you distinguish the case that Lemons is relying on that we decided within a few years of the woman who was in the apartment with the drugs and also had knowledge, and we concluded that those facts, presence and knowledge, did not add up to conspiracy?
Well, Your Honor, in that case, I think that the problem was, and that was Jan White, the drug case, what the court had decided was, and it used the term the mere presence language in that circumstance. The problem was there was no direct or circumstantial evidence in that case of any concert of action regarding the drugs between her and her son. Here there is. There is concert of action between the two, showing the gun, the passing the gun, the going together. It's a far different circumstance than when the police come into a house and say, everybody who lives here, you're all responsible for the drugs here. And I think that's my nutshell version of what the court said isn't sufficient in Ms. White's case. So it was a far different circumstance than I would suggest is present here. There is clearly concert of action. There clearly is all those things. The only question is whether or not the jury was rational and made a rational decision in determining that the agreement was for the purpose of committing a murder. And I'd suggest respectfully that the evidence does support that.
And you attribute that in part to whatever you characterize as the circumstances of the neighborhood, that everyone knows that while most rational people don't kill someone because they're insulted, that it was pretty much to be expected that once these people were insulted in public, the only alternative was to murder the person.
Yeah, Your Honor, I wouldn't put that as a character of the neighborhood. I would put it as a character of these two people, these people who decided that is an executable offense and worked together to do it and had no problem with it, obviously. Including
what was the state's evidence to support the theory that these two people only had one alternative once they were insulted, and that was to murder the person that insulted them?
Not that they only had one alternative, but they apparently determined that there would be only one response.
I know, but what was the state's evidence that supports that?
I suggest the flashing of the gun, the discussion, and the activity that they went up and did exactly that. I think perhaps one of the things that the jury could also depend on is the lack of action by Mr. Lemons after the shooting. Let's assume that he went up and they said for a moment, and the evidence in some way supported that, look, I was in for shooting in the knee, but I wasn't in for shooting in the head. He didn't do anything about it. He didn't say, oh my gosh, what are you doing? He didn't flee from Branch. He didn't do anything else. They continued and ran away together. So I think the jury can look at each of these steps and say, I believe beyond a reasonable doubt that he was in for the shooting in the head also. I may not have made that decision. Your Honor may not make that decision. These two people did on that day. And they heard each witness. They saw the evidence. And they determined that that's what they believe the agreement was. And I'd suggest certainly the evidence can support it. There are no other questions.
Thank you.
If I may, with respect to Mr. Wallace's point that the two men ran away together following the shooting, I would indicate that my recollection of the record is that everybody ran away. If by together Mr. Wallace meant at the same time, then they ran away together. But if he meant they ran away in the same direction together as one concerted action, I would take issue with that. The record does not indicate that the two ran together to the same place, to a car, to a house, or anything. Simply that Mr. Biddle ran away, Mr. Washington ran away, Mr. Lemons ran away, Mr. Branch ran away, Ms. Watson ran away, and Ms. Briscoe ran away. Mr. Owens ran away and then came back, because he had been with Mr. Anderson.
Let me interrupt for a second. Do you disagree with the state's position that the result is some evidence of what the agreement was?
Yes, I do. I agree. I would agree with Mr. Wallace that one potential inference of a discussion that nobody fully heard, if there really was more discussion that wasn't heard, could be any number of things. But what Mr. Branch ended up doing may not have been what was the subject of the agreement.
No, I understand that. But if I understand the state's position correctly, the state says there's this circumstantial evidence that they made an agreement and the end result was murder. Therefore, one could reasonably infer that that was what the agreement was. And I'm asking you whether you dispute the validity of that premise, that one can attribute some circumstantial value to there being an agreement to kill by the fact that there was a murder.
I will not say that there is no circumstantial value to what happened later. But where I do take issue with the state's argument is that the state would have this court uphold what it would appear to be a single rational inference without testing it to make sure that it's actually a rational juror finding based upon their view of the evidence, giving the state the benefit of viewing it in its most favorable light, that it proves anything beyond a reasonable doubt. If one permissible inference, if it is one, is that murder first degree was the intent of a plan and that a plan was found, a rational juror still has to find that beyond a reasonable doubt. And there was no other evidence.
Is it fair to say that a rational jury would look carefully at the way in which the victim was shot, namely shot in the head from a very short distance? Would it have been different, by way of example, if going by Mr. Anderson, either Branch or Lemons, had shot them in the thigh, taunted him, and then run and simply didn't call 911, and he bled to death on the sidewalk? Is that the kind of factual distinction that a rational jury could infer, that this was a plan to kill, to commit a homicide, rather than just to assault him with the weapon or some other kind of retaliation?
I would say that a rational juror should consider all the circumstances, and that would include the circumstances that Your Honor discusses, but I would not believe that that would show a plan. It would show the shooter's intent, and that the shooter may have intended to place a gun at close range to somebody's head with the purpose of killing them.
Now, were these arguments or similar arguments made to the jury, that the evidence was insufficient to show a conspiracy?
Your Honor, I will concede that my focus was the murder first degree, and I don't believe that I focused to any great extent upon conspiracy when arguing to the jury. And my recollection is that the state went through the indictment and went through each charge and explained to the jury what all of the elements of all the offenses were. But with respect to my argument on behalf of Mr. Lemons, I don't believe I went through that.
Didn't you request a special instruction on your presence? Wasn't that argued?
I requested the instruction, and it was there, and I certainly talked about how someone who's merely present is not guilty, but I did not go in any depth like this or in any more depth, probably, with respect to the
conspiracy.
Well,
let me ask you a hypothetical. Let's suppose we had a tape recording of everything these two people said. and the tape recording revealed the following. Lemons says to the other person with the gun, what are you going to do? And the other person says, well, I'm going to go kill him. And Lemons says, well, I want to see that. And they walk, and the facts happen. Has Lemons committed a crime?
I think if a fact finder concluded that in him saying, I want to see that, that was providing encouragement or assistance in egging on somebody to commit that crime, then yes. There are people who watch terrible things all the time.
We'd have a whole hour oral argument over what that really meant. What did you mean by that? I really want to see. Who knows?
Agreed.
All right, thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.